Hi, it's Bill Teepel with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. Well, we have decided to discuss today why we do this at all. Why do artists create? What is it that's in it for us, since it doesn't seem to be money? But there's something that we get that people will wait in long lines at museums to see when there's a big blockbuster show of a Monet exhibit or a Van Gogh. Or there's something about going and looking at these aesthetic objects that yields a reward. Why? What is this reward, and why do we want it?
And why did the artists want to make those things in the first place?
So is he getting a reward when he does it, regardless of if anyone else sees it, or does he make it so that someone else will get his reward and they'll feel some sense of communion?
Well, it's probably a mix of a reward and suffering, I think, if you read the lives of artists or you go and reflect on your own experience, because the impulse to make art, I mean, in my own experience, the impulse to make art is often the peak. And then once I begin actually making it, working on something,
the suffering
more of a struggle,
begins.
You know?
It's like, we all know that.
There can be great joy. There can be waves of great joy in that process as well. But then there can also be, you know, some all sorts of complex things that come up in the process of making it. And yet I keep doing it and have been doing it my whole life in spite of this mix.
Well, for me, it's a learning process. And learning can be awkward and uncomfortable, especially if you fight it. But I guess I don't see suffering in the process. The worse I feel, the less likely I am to actually want to create anything. Although I'm sure some people may be able to use creating things as an escape from their normal state of mind or something, or maybe it's an escape to their normal state of mind. For me, the satisfaction comes in conceiving of something and thinking how great it would be if I could make one. And then there's more satisfaction in solving the problems required to create it, because I usually have no idea how I'm going to build it. And once I've started, I run into these blanks in the process, and I think, gee, how am I going to do that? I haven't a clue. Like when I was building the audio distributor machine that was hanging in the back room at the Ashtanga Kosh installation, the 8-channel installation at Gallery 51 a couple of summers ago, I knew that I needed a machine, a system of some kind, to direct an audio signal to first one speaker and then another speaker and then another, and there were 8 speakers. At first I thought, well, I'll just have to get 8 amplifiers and, 8 channels of audio. And I thought, no, that's a total waste. That's ridiculous. Because only one speaker is ever on at a time. So I need something like a distributor in a car engine, something that'll send the juice that makes the spark to the appropriate spark plug. And one of the problems I faced was I need something that will turn. I decided on a round thing, with an arm, and the arm would trip a different switch as it moved around. And the problem was I wanted the arm to be trying to turn all the time. Either that, or I had to come up with a servo motor system, which involved a lot more expense and a lot more electronics and a lot more complexity. And I really just wanted to make something that looked cool and did the job. And so I spent about a week having absolutely no idea how I was going to do that. And then suddenly I realized fan motors, the kind that you have in personal computers and little gizmos, it's a kind of synchronous motor that essentially is always trying to turn. And they have very low power. And if you stick your finger in it, it'll hurt a little, but it probably won't do any damage. And the thing just stops. And when you pull your finger out, it starts up again. And they're designed to run on 12 volts. So I went to Radio Shack and bought a little fan motor and turned it on, hooked it up to a 12-volt supply. and stuck a pencil in it so it couldn't turn, just to see, you know, if it minded. And after about a half an hour, it had gotten pretty hot, and I realized if I left it like that, you know, all day for a month or two at the gallery, it would probably melt. So I tried running it on 6 volts, and it turned out that it worked fine on 6 volts. It didn't spin at, you know, 5,000 RPM, but I only wanted it to try and turn. So I solved this problem in a very peculiar way, and it was tremendously satisfying, even though it was a microscopic portion of that process. But anyway, then, you know, I also get satisfaction from seeing that it's completed. And I get a tremendous amount of satisfaction from seeing someone enjoy it. So it's really the whole process before, during, and after.
I think that the struggle comes when you, because what we're talking about is the gap between conceiving of something, having an idea, something in consciousness on the mental plane, and then driving it into manifestation. And I think the struggle for some comes when it gets really an anxiety over whether one can bring it off or not, or in the middle there's this uncertainty about bringing it off, and then the huge ecstasy and the agony and the ecstasy is this, like, that it's actually been brought into manifestation. And I think that artists get off on this process. But it sounds to me like you love the problem solving.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you have confidence you're going to get there.
Well, but you know, there's an interesting wrinkle. As I was listening to you just now, I was thinking, you're coming from primarily a painting orientation. And in painting, you have a different set of parameters. In my case, if the fan motor thing doesn't work, no one will ever hear about it. I'll find some other thing, and when I'm done, it'll work. But with a painting, if you think, you know, it needs a whole lot of blue over there and a real heavy impasto, and you go and apply it, and then you think, that completely ruined it. You know, you're taking a much greater risk in putting more paint on the canvas than I am in experimenting with you know, a fan and discovering that it does or doesn't work.
So to me, in listening to you, both of you just said, it seems like there are two elements. There's the struggle, there's like the challenge element where you have this kind of intention and you move in that direction, and you may have a lot of trial and error, and even if you are a painter, you may start a whole new canvas realizing you've on the wrong track, or you may be able to salvage it or change the direction you were going in. And that usually isn't so much suffering as just the challenge and the kind of energizing ongoing process. The suffering seems to come by emotions that come in from time to time, possibly about doubts of whether you actually are making art or it's just trash, or whether you are actually, or you have something that you are very stuck on wanting to express in a certain way, and you're just not, it's just not happening, and you try over and over again, and you know, you just want it to happen in a certain way, and so there's a lot of conflicting emotions, I think, that's the part that causes the suffering element. That's a totally separate thing from the struggle of solving a problem.
I guess I see it as being totally separate from the art. It's sort of like, well, some people, you know, hassle themselves about whether they're going to succeed or not, but they would do that whether it was, you know, interviewing for a job or painting a painting.
Yeah, the doing the art holds up a mirror to that stuff within you. So you watch yourself going through your stuff, because this brings up the original idea. I mean, why do we do this? What does it yield? And it's almost a life and death matter for the artist. And that's why you go through such intense emotions over the thing, or your self-doubt and everything will come into play. What makes art such a life and death matter? Is it that the subtlest, tenderest, like, depths of your soul are being addressed?
Exposed.
Exposed, yeah.
Well, and it depends on what you're what kind of art you're producing. I mean, nobody knows what the cavemen were feeling when they painted bison on the walls of the caves. There's speculation that they were feeling that this was a power thing. You know, they were creating some kind of power or protection or good luck or something like that by painting these images on the walls of their caves, but nobody knows for sure what those feelings were. Mm-hmm. And then there are the Academy painters who worked in teams and painted. There was somebody who was skilled at doing backgrounds and somebody who was skilled at doing the leaves and the trees. And then there was like the master artist whose name got on the canvas who came in and did the fine stuff at the end. And was their relationship to their work the same emotionally as Jackson Pollock or the abstract expressionists who are trying to paint what was in their inner souls and give form to that? So it's not a simple answer.
I think that what we're talking about is aesthetics, and where aesthetics interfaces with magic, we're not going to address at the moment. Maybe we are, because I think that the cavemen were dealing with magic, and I think that there are artists today that are even dealing with magical, spiritual connections. But that aesthetics, I think, has to do with the element of beauty, the experience of beauty.
Now, can you actually separate beauty from magic?
No, I don't think
you
can. All right. So.
Let's try to define
this stuff. And because I was talking, let me go back and we can address the issue of where does magic and spiritual connection and unity experiences come into this. But when you look at the 19th century marine painting with all the yard arms.
Mm-hmm.
And they're rigging.
Yeah, they're rigging.
And then you've got the Jackson Pollock. I think that those are cultural differences that make a difference in what they look like, because I think there's a similar experience for the viewer standing in front of the thing when he says yes.
You know,
that's so cool. And to me, that's the aesthetic experience. And
which isn't dependent on what culture or time period you actually grew up in or lived in. You go over to places in Europe where that you have huge range of eras of art in one museum, and it's always astonishing to me to be in these long lines waiting to get in to see. I mean, the Sistine Chapel ceiling is probably one of the longest lines in Europe to get in, and people will stand, you know, in the hot sun in Rome, they'll stand there waiting for hours to get in and see, and you'll see all kinds of people, all ages, all cultures, waiting to see, and it's worth it.
Don't you think accessibility plays a role? I mean, in our culture, eclecticism is well established, but in the caveman's culture, you know, a painting of the Mona Lisa might not be even immediately recognized. You know, we mentioned the other day how, you know, it's not really established that when a cat sees a picture of a cat, that it recognizes that it's even looking at an image of a cat. It may just see it as patterns of light and dark that mean nothing because there's no cat smell in the air or something. Mm. And you know, when I first saw a Pollock, it was a tiny little image in Life magazine. It wasn't a big painting or anything. It wasn't impressive. It didn't look very different from things I had done with crayons when I was very young. And I didn't relate to it the way I did when I saw the first one in the flesh. And so, you know, yes, there is a depth to, you know, certain kinds of works of art. Especially those, you know, done by most of the people we recognize as being great. But I'm not sure that, you know, it cuts across culture boundaries as effortlessly as it seems nowadays when we're in a multicultural world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you grew up in, in medieval Europe, some of these things would it would be inconceivable to consider them to be paintings.
Maybe you can go back, but you can't go forward in terms of your perception of...
Well,
you
know, yeah, that's what the artist is trying to do, is probably go forward, at least forward for himself.
Right, yeah.
Well, yeah,
but you might do that by studying the ones who, you know,
well,
did
we're
that.
In an age of appropriation. I mean, we're definitely pulling. I mean, we always have worked out of a tradition, but right now we're really going back and picking up everything from the past and putting it together in this postmodern expression of today.
Kind of raises the bar on innocence because we're so jaded. It's hard to do something that's purely your own.
Which goes back to the original question again. We keep this. This is a difficult question.
Yeah, I think we're
directly
having trouble.
You know?
We're really slipping off of this really easily
today.
Yeah,
because it's a subtle point. It's like it addresses what you just said. Is this innocence? What is the pure innocent impulse that makes any artist, regardless of their time period or background or age or anything, want to make something? Want to create something. What is that?
Yeah. Well, Agnes Martin said, a couple of things that really seemed to address that, at least, for her. One was that, she paints with her back to the world. She's not painting stuff that she sees out here. And another was that she painted for 30 or 40 years and didn't like anything she painted, and every year she'd burn them. And it would be wonderful to see what she did and, what the evolution was until she got to the point where she painted something she liked, which happened to be an inner perception that, sort of surprisingly is representable, as an almost representational painting. And so she's painting something that she likes. And, she said people told her, she should paint more blue ones or whatever it was, and she didn't want to. So I think in her case, that sort of spectrum of why I like to do what I do is just shifted differently. The balance is different. She does it more for inner reasons, doesn't seem to care very much whether other people get it or not. But I'm sure she likes it when other people get it, because we are, social beings, and you have to be pretty unusual not to have any interest in what anyone else thinks.
So it's still, though, what you just said. I keep feeling like the question is like down here somewhere, and the answers keep leaping over here and leaping over here, because it's, perspective.
This is as slippery as talking about reality itself.
Yeah, exactly. Like, is there?
And maybe that's what it is we're talking about.
Right.
And we're slipping off of this. It's slippery sliding.
Well, the question is, why do we create?
Yeah, is there some kind of universal element? Let's say, maybe ask it that way. Or is it all just individual? Like Agnes Martin does it for this reason and somebody else does it for this reason. Or is there something subtler than all of those reasons that has made the persona of an artist a part of just about every society? Is what makes a person want to be an artist?
Well, okay. I hear about six questions in that, the way you just phrased it. It has to do with creativity. It has to do with who defines an artist. You've got a transcultural art definition that you're using there that we haven't really, taken a close look at. I'm not sure that what we would call an artist among the Kwakiutl or the Mundugumur, since I'm in a Ruth Benedict frame of mind today, would be something that they would consider to be an artist. Mm-hmm. They would call him a shaman. Mm-hmm. And yet there are other people in other cultures, and if you're trying to think of extremely different other cultures, who are doing decorative things, but it's not considered anything, special. It's like what you do. You always put the fancy fringe on the tops of the mukluks. It's just the way you make them.
And yeah, so, but there's the guy that's going to say, wow, very cool. you put the blue and the red together this time, and wow, I love it.
Sure. Sure. I'm just saying that one of the questions inherent in what Donna was saying was, you know, where do you start calling this person an artist? And
well, let's do that one first. Let's go there.
Okay.
We have time to go anywhere.
Yeah, we could go for...
All right. I would say that an artist is someone who does creative things, and of course that includes everyone so far, but who does them deliberately. With an interest in the creative process. And that's all it takes to be an artist.
I mean, I think the artist is constantly reforming culture. I mean, the structure that is established at this moment is an illusion, and it's an agreed-upon illusion, and that the artist is semi-consciously working with reforming and taking us into the future, into a new illusion that's in the direction he would like to take it, and that's why he says, "This is what I like."
So this is what I mean,
that's what I'd like the future to look like.
Yeah, it's sort of like maybe it's each person inside has some desire to create Eden in their own interpretation of that, something surrounding them that makes life more beautiful or more enriching or more stimulating or something like that, that in the process of creating something they feel this forward moving.
Well, some people feel they have to destroy to make it move forward because things are stuck.
Yeah.
So their acts look destructive, but in fact they're trying to reformulate the future in a more truthful way.
I think the motivation is always I want more. I think that's the basic motivation. And if you're creatively oriented, then you think in terms of how do I get more? Maybe I can make more. A different kind of personality might start looking at for the checkbook and heading out the door for the mall to get more. But there's always, you know, for an artist who's trying to make an impact on society or make a statement about society, it's because they want more of the satisfaction that comes from nailing it, from somehow capturing the essence of what's right with society or what's wrong with society. And for the artist who just likes to paint, you know, lilies all day long, and I know someone who paints fantastic little watercolor flowers, and she just loves it. She paints probably 1,000 of them a year. And part of it is that she loves the idea that she has painted hundreds of them. Another part of it is that she can sell them, because she obviously doesn't take her very long. They're watercolors, and she does 1,000 or two in a year, so it's only a few minutes invested in each one. So she earns a living painting flowers. But she really is an artist. She's just fascinated by the subtleties of these flowers, and you'd have to study her output to see what she sees in it. And some people would say, well, certainly, you know, it's not great art, but be that as it may, she is being creative and getting more out of that. But it's so easy to always sort of come back to art as painting or a variation on that.
Well, when I'm talking of in asking this question, I'm not talking about the art scene or an artist, you know, a fine artist as opposed to a craftsperson or something. I'm talking about any person who has an impulse to create something. Like you said at the beginning, it could be create a meal or to decorate your room or to go to a gallery and buy a painting to hang on your wall that you're going to look at all the time, or a little child doing a crayon drawing for the first time.
And when she is painting her flowers, she seems to be so into it. She's having an experience.
Yeah.
When she gets it right for herself, or when she declares, you know, this is one of those, and I've just said something about it, she's having an aesthetic experience, and she's having a completion experience.
Yeah, that's the completion thing. I think she's doing it to get more of that experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why we do it. I mean, yeah. I really think that's why we do this
thing. Yeah, it's like an addiction. In this, yeah. But then if you look at closely at anything that people do, whether you call it creative or not, we all kind of operate on the basis of an addiction. It's an addiction to what we feel we must do, and we just don't feel comfortable unless we're doing that. And some people, you know, it's following a set of rules that someone gave them. Other people, it's breaking the rules that anyone might give them.
Well, and it goes back to the first point that you made when you were talking about what you, this kind of satisfaction you get when you're working on a project, that it has to do with growth. And, you know, and that relates to what I was talking about in relation to struggle. It's like a little child who suddenly realizes that people walk on two legs and the child is just crawling around and starts to stand up. I mean, there's like a tremendous struggle and so much trial and error in the process of learning how to walk or how to speak. And yet the drive is intense to grow and to master these skills that are going to give you bigger access to what life offers. So it's probably something, you know, the basic impulse is probably something related to that, that when you find that you're able to create something new,
you get more,
express something new, it's a kind of growth that doesn't take place in other categories of life, maybe.
Well, I mean, I think it's tapping more directly into the primal urge of manifestation, the primal, causes the universe to come about in the first place. And other people get more a little bit boxed in into some, I mean, it's driving the whole thing, but more people get boxed in, and the artist is trying to constantly stay on this primal urge and figure
it
out.
We are, you know, living beings, which means we are embodiments of life, however abstract that may sound. But life is perhaps the perfect opposite of entropy. Entropy is you leave something alone and it turns into a pile of dust. Life is you start with a pile of seeming dust and you end up with a creature running around doing things, making more things, pulling orderliness out of the chaos. And that's the life force.
Yeah, so that's the crux of it. Life is the artist, and we're just, each one of us is just a little hair in the brush of the great artist.
Yeah, just trying to emulate
participating.
It.
Participating.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.